From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines followed by The Skeptic. Here's what's happening. A 60-year-old Orange County, California man has died after receiving a second dose of the coronavirus vaccine. Now, investigators are trying to determine if the vaccination played any role in his death. Hours after getting his second Pfizer dose on January 5th, Tim Zook was in the emergency room in the hospital where he worked. He wasn't feeling good. He had stomach problems. And then he passed away a couple days later. Johnson & Johnson said that its single-dose vaccine was 66% effective in preventing COVID-19 in a large global trial against multiple variants, which will give health officials another weapon to hopefully tackle this coronavirus. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, currently studying the effectiveness of double masks, specifically a cloth mask placed over a medical mask, in stopping coronavirus spread and stopping it all over the place, but they don't have enough hard data to determine whether it'll be better than using a single mask. Let's check in with Christian Wild, myheartbook.com, who, of course, has some updates for us on the coronavirus. He's been looking into vaccinations. Hi, Christian. What do you have for us?
Well, George, let's see if we can put this miserable virus into some kind of perspective. During the 6 years of World War II, 407,000 Americans lost their lives. We keep in mind that that was from a six-year war. Now, by comparison, COVID-19 in just a single year, not 6 years, has claimed more American lives than the entire six-year World War. Does that give us some idea of what we are dealing with?
A mess.
And, of course, yes, it is. It isn't over. And don't we continue to get confusing and mixed information from the experts? George, correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't we told by the World Health Organization when we first heard about COVID to practice 3 feet of social separation? And like good dogs, we all complied, and then suddenly, halfway through the year, the CDC challenged the three-foot rule, advising us we should now practice 6 feet of social distancing.
And they didn't say it was airborne. I did. Now they
you
say
did.
It's airborne.
I remember the day you said it.
Yep.
And so how many infections and possible deaths could have been avoided if they had told us the preferred 6 foot distance rule in the first place? Maybe when we doubt, we need to rely a little bit more on our own common sense, because things are changing every day. And as far as masks are concerned, a year into the pandemic, experts like Dr. Fauci now suggest we consider wearing 2 or even 3 masks. And before we began tonight, George, I've added the list of what may be the safest masks. And the N95 may still prove to be one of the very safest. I added them to the website.
Great.
The least effective are those light blue masks that most of us wear all the time.
Yeah, those are junk, aren't they?
They're junk. They're paper thin. You can see through them.
And they're cheap.
They're cheap. Yeah, George, have you heard that already this month of January, and have your listeners heard, some 900 Americans have been poisoned by hand sanitizers from Mexico that contain dangerous levels of contaminants, including wood alcohol. And according to CBS News, these sanitizers are strongly affecting our young children. Parents, you might want to take a look at the website when you have time and see what the FDA and CDC warnings of 500 banned sanitizers may unknowingly be using.
It's a mess right now. And of course, as you know, they are recommending that women who are pregnant do not get the vaccine. You might want to, caution on the side of caution and err on the side of caution and not get the vaccine if you are a pregnant woman. A class action lawsuit filed last week in California accuses Subway, the Connecticut-based fast food giant, of fraud and false advertising over the content of its tuna sandwiches, which the suit claims is an entirely non-tuna-based mixture that the defendants blended to resemble tuna and imitate its texture. Subway denied the allegations, telling news organizations it delivers 100% cooked tuna to its restaurants, which is mixed with mayonnaise and used in freshly made sandwiches. Let's check in with food safety coach Jeff Nelkin. Jeff, what's this thing all about?
It sounds like Charlie isn't safe any longer.
They deny it vehemently. That's easy to prove, isn't it?
Absolutely. All they have to do is send it, you know, to a lab to verify the nature of what the product is and if it's not the protein source that it originated from. Now, there were studies done maybe a couple of years ago when tuna, for example, went up in price. Some of the sushi restaurants were calling it super tuna. And super tuna was basically a less expensive fish. Commonly, Escalar, as an example, was found to be substitute. So they found about 20% of the seafood in Los Angeles, for example, were misrepresented. And it's always interesting when there's a misrepresentation that it's always the equal is price. So whatever substitute they put in to make it look like tuna, they converted it into a less expensive but similar looking seafood. The problem with Escalar is that if you eat too much Escalar, it's a high fat fish, it goes right through you. And there are complications. People get scared when they eat too much Escalar. So that happened in one of the major supermarkets. They were, you know, because it's an inexpensive fish. But like you said, it comes down to Subway has a quality assurance, support system that verify everything that they do in their operations. And all it really simply takes is to take a sample of the product and have it sent to a lab to verify that it is either tuna or it's not tuna.
Simple as that. Jeff, thank you so much. Jeff Nelkin, our food safety coach. NASA is sending its Perseverance rover to Mars, of course. It's just 3 weeks away now from arriving. The robot and the red planet are still separated by some 4.5 million miles, but this gap is closing at a very rapid rate. It's going to be exciting. What's going on in the skies with UFO activity? Let's check in with our own Kevin Randall. Kevin, what do you have for us this week, my friend?
Hey, George, how you doing?
Okay.
Well, I was going to say that there are many subsets to UFO research. And I've mentioned some of them in the past, including cases of electromagnetic effects, occupant reports, and national security aspects. Tonight, I'm looking at sightings by airline crews and passengers, but must say that some of this has come off the rails lately. I'll get to that in a moment. First, an update from last week when I was talking about EM effects and color changes on cars. On July 20th, 1954, two men driving near Oslo, Norway, were chased by an object for several minutes. They stopped their car to observe it hovering a short distance away. A watch stopped working, and the paint on the car changed color. I have additional information about one of the cases I discussed last week and another similar case I just learned about posted on my blog. Just a couple of hours ago, as I was reviewing tonight's report, I once again looked at the data, which changed everything. One of the most exciting airline reports was made on January 17th of this year. According to the original story, a passenger on a Singapore Airlines aircraft filmed what was described as a white object as it flew beneath the aircraft as they came in for a landing at the Zurich airport. Now I learn there's controversy around this sighting, with some suggesting the video was not taken on a Singapore Airlines aircraft. The landscape looks too green for it to be Zurich in January. And most important is that the person who shot the video has now removed it from YouTube. I mention this case because it's necessary for us to look at all aspects of a sighting, and sometimes a really exciting sighting just blows up as new details are discovered. This case right now appears to be a hoax, and I thought it important to include it to show that our work just is never done. Others seem to have withstood the additional scrutiny. On October 15th last year, the pilot of a commercial airliner that had just taken off from Heathrow International Airport saw a bright red object fly alongside the left side of the aircraft. It was no more than 20 feet from the airplane and about 3,000 feet above the ground, which is more than seven times the altitude allowed for drone aircraft. Although there has been no identification of the object, a weather balloon or some other terrestrial object has not been ruled out, though I would suggest that they wouldn't be launching weather balloons so close to the active runways. This is not a new phenomenon. Just days after Kenneth Arnold had reported nine objects in fast flight near Mount Rainier, Washington, Captain E.J. Smith and the crew of a United Airlines DC-3 on July 4, 1947, saw a number of objects approach their aircraft. The co-pilot reached down to flash the landing lights at what he first thought was an airplane coming at them. Smith said that they saw four or five somethings in front of his DC-3. He said that they watched the UFOs as they seemed to pace the aircraft for 10 to 15 minutes. Smith didn't see a real shape, but said they were flat on the bottom and were irregular on the top. Finally, the object just disappeared in a burst of speed. This sighting, however, and unlike the Singapore Airlines video mentioned earlier, is not wrapped in controversy. It was investigated by the Army Air Forces and was eventually labeled as unidentified. This is, of course, just a sample of these cases. I have additional information and other sightings at my blog, A Different Perspective. And that's what I have for this week, George.
You got it, Kevin. Thanks. We'll talk to you next Friday. Kevin Randall's blog, of course, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. In a moment, we're going to talk about tarot cards and what it means to you on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast for the next couple hours. We're going to talk about tarot cards and you. Matter of fact, next hour, Art Rosengarten will be doing some readings about you. He'll be selecting tarot cards and talking about your future. The Tarot with Art Rosengarten. Art is back on the program, a regular guest on the show. Art, welcome back, my friend. It's been a while.
It's been a while, George. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How about you? You weathering the storm out there?
Are you talking about San Diego?
How about the COVID storm?
Oh, this storm.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine with it. Just got my first vaccination, and so I'm feeling a little bit better than I was last week when I hadn't gotten it yet. So, yeah.
Good. No reaction to it? You okay there?
No, it's fine.
That's great. Yeah. Art, let's get into tarot. For a lot of people who don't know what they are, tell us about the tarot deck and how it started.
Okay, well, the tarot is really originated in the Italian Renaissance in the late 1300s, early 1400s, and then spread through Europe in the 1500s and 1600s, and kind of landed in France. With the Marseille Tarot. Now, the thing about it, and from France, it again continued to evolve. It became more magical, more metaphysical in France, and then moved to England at the late 19th century with the Society of the Golden Dawn, and finally landed in America in the early 20th century, and then kind of came into a kind of wider collective knowledge in the 1960s. But the truth is, no one truly knows the origin of tarot. It's a mystery.
How many cards in a tarot deck, Art?
78. It's really comprised of two decks, the minor arcana and the major arcana. The minor arcana is roughly equivalent to the standard playing cards, you know, four suits, ace through king. In the tarot, there's 56 minor arcana cards, not 52 like in standard playing cards, because in the court cards, there's also four knights that were removed from standard playing cards, something. But then there is an additional 22 cards. These were formerly called the trumps. So, for political reasons, I prefer to call them the higher keys.
Yeah.
And there are 22 of these. These are considered certainly by me as a Jungian psychologist to represent the archetypes of transformation. These are the big cards, the ones that have, the deeper meaning. And there are 22 classic trump cards or hierarchies. In my work, I've added 5 cards to a full 27 major keys in the major arcana of the tarot.
The artwork for these cards, Art, has always fascinated me, the way they're depicted. Have they changed over the years, or are they still pretty much the same?
Oh, my goodness. Very much. They have, now there's a profusion of tarot decks. There's, I don't know what it is now, but I imagine it's probably about 800 or 900 commercially available tarot decks. Based on different artistic interpretations of the same, there's really one tarot deck, but there are many artistic interpretations of each card that vary from deck to deck, though there are certain motifs in the tarot that are consistent throughout all decks, or should be. And there just may be different artistic kind of versions of them. It's one tarot deck, but many different kind of styles of depicting the cards.
We've talked about this before, Art, but when we get into readings next hour with our callers, if you pull like the death card, that doesn't mean that person's going to die, does it?
Yeah, it does. But George, it means... If you get the death card, it means you're going to die. However, it doesn't say when. We're all going to die.
We're all going to go.
I'll tell you before. Now, every card that you get, it represents a possibility, kind of the core universal possibilities of the human experience. So death certainly is being one of them. It doesn't so much say you predict you're going to die. What it does is it holds a mirror of a particular theme or issue, say like death or birth or whatever. And in that moment, it allows you to reflect on that particular theme. Now, if you have several cards at the same time that are in designated spread positions that, have fixed meanings like, say, past, present, future, and you get, say, the death card in the past, which would be kind of interesting, then you are left to kind of now wrap your imagination around that. What could that be saying? Is it pointing, is it asking me to think about people who have died? Is it pointing me to think about past lifetimes? It gets more complex and interesting in a tarot reading because there's spontaneous selections randomly of cards that are put in pre-designated positions, spread positions. And so you look at the synergy between the symbol that you've picked and the spread position and see what emerges. So it gets very interesting.
It sure does. Art, what website are you using these days?
It's moonlightcounseling.com, or you can just go artrosengarten.com. It takes you to the same place.
Okay, we got a link set up for you at coasttocoastam.com as well. The cards of the cards that are in the tarot deck, are some of them bad?
No. Bad, I don't like the word bad. Are some challenging and difficult? Yes, definitely. And there's but every card, I believe, George, has a positive and negative aspect to it. Even the best cards have a shadow side, and even the so-called worst cards has a positive way of looking at it. Now, if a card comes in upside down, which is called a reversal, that can mean several things, but typically it means looking at the shadow side or the dark side of the card. But yes, in terms of bad cards, people usually find in the minor arcana the
many of the swords, the suit of swords, to be kind of difficult to look at. I mean, the pictures are somewhat troubling, but the meanings of them are not quite the way the picture depicts.
Hold on, Art. We're going to take a break and come right back and talk more on Coast to Coast AM. Art Rosengarten talking about tarot cards. We will take calls with Art Rosengarten next hour, and what he needs from you is a question. Then he pulls the card, and then he'll tell you a little bit about what you can expect. So we're going to do that next hour. When we come back in a moment, I'll be chatting with him more about tarot cards. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Art Rosengarten. We'll take calls with Art next hour. And again, what he needs is a solid question from you. Then he pulls a card and takes it away. Kings and queens of that era, Art, did they get the tarot readings?
No, I think of the early era, it was more for the kind of the a gift in the artwork in the the noble people enjoyed the in a way they interpreted it through nobility and kind of the themes of their time. They didn't really understand much about the metaphysical side of tarot. That came later when it moved to France and the magicians and metaphysicians started discovering that the symbols really were connected to a lot of the ancient mystery schools and metaphysical sorts of teachings, and then it became more interesting to the occult and spiritual types of people and like that. So tarot didn't really take off as a divinatory tool, I believe, until about the 18th century.
Was it ever used like a parlor game where, in those days they didn't have radio and television?
Yeah, I believe so. I believe it was used as more of a parlor game or a collectible sort of thing. These gilded decks, they'd hire some of the finest artists in like Milan and various centers to produce this beautiful deck of cards, and they may have played games with them. I'm not really all that knowledgeable about the early history of that period with tarot, but it was not really used for divination until several centuries later.
Did they have special readers of the tarot? I mean, did you have to be specially trained in those days? I guess you do now.
Well, I think all of the tarot readers, et cetera, it was believed that the gypsies brought the tarot to Europe, but that's been debunked, that theory. The gypsies may have been reading standard playing cards early, I believe, but I don't think the gypsies actually started using tarot until the early 20th century, is from what I understand. The more interesting part of it is that no one knows exactly who the first designers were, and I have my own theories about that. There's... some people say it came from the ancient Egyptians, for instance. Mm-hmm. Some people say it came from the Arabs. Some believe it came all the way from China or India. There's a lot of competing theories about that, but I don't think that question has been settled yet.
How about the church? What did the church ever say about tarot in those days?
That's interesting because... people kind of wrongly, as I understand it, believe that the church outlawed the use of tarot, but that's not true. They did They did sanction against playing cards and gambling,
mm-hmm.
but I don't believe that the tarot, when the tarot first appeared in Renaissance Italy, I don't believe there was any injunction against tarot from what I've read in tarot history.
Has tarot ever been looked at, Art, as part of witchcraft or anything like that?
Oh, yes.
It has.
And there are plenty of people today that that use it for Wicca or witchcraft or that sort of thing. That's not my particular interest, but as a matter of fact, I think currently there is kind of a resurgence of some. It's a very wide community, and there's people that, you in the tarot world. It's comprised of, artists and spiritual people and then metaphysics and occultists and, Wiccans and witches. And now I'm a psychologist, as George.
Yeah.
And so I tend to use the tarot for its symbolism and as a symbolic tool, much like dream work. And I think that the tarot is very rich in psychological imagery and can be used to help a person pull out a lot of repressed material, as well as open up new possibilities or have visual markers that describe what they're feeling that words can't really capture correctly. So there are many different approaches to the tarot, and it's hard to lump it in any single school.
You are one of the most authoritative persons with the tarot. How did you get involved with it in the first place?
Okay, believe it or not, in graduate school.
Really?
Yeah. But I went to in San Francisco, I went to the California Institute of Asian Studies. That was the school before it changed and grew into the California Institute of Integral Studies, which maybe some people are more familiar with. But it was kind of an East-West graduate school where people came to study, Eastern spirituality and religion, as well as Western psychology, transpersonal psychology, and Jungian psychology. And I took a weekend seminar by actually a scholar of Indian philosophy who also happened to be very interested in the tarot. I took a weekend workshop with her, and it was fabulous. I thought it was so interesting, and it had so much potential as a psychological instrument that I ended up writing my doctoral dissertation on the use of tarot cards in psychotherapy, or how that might be approached in many different ways, by comparing tarot readings to dream interpretations and then psychological projective testing to see if the tarot cards could actually be as effective as some of these other tools that psychologists use, the projective tests and dream analysis. And found that in many areas, the tarot was just as effective, if not more effective, but the difference being the tarot comes magically. The tarot comes from random selection, and somehow by just selecting cards in the procedure of a reading, one is able to pull out as much relevant psychological information as they might from a test, which is asking the person, or at least revealing, the person's revealing through their dreams, their experience is remarkable. It was really a tool that's based totally on synchronicity, is actually as effective as some of these other psychological tools. So that really interested me in it.
Now, when we take calls next hour, Art, and you're going to pull a card for... Are you going to pull one card or three?
No, three cards.
Okay. Which is what you've always done, right?
The KTRS spread, I call it.
Yeah, right? Absolutely, yeah. In those days.
That's right.
And when you pull the three cards, do you need all three together, or are each one separate in terms of what the reading is?
Three positions. The first card will represent whatever they ask, whatever the question. You can ask me about, you know, shadow people and you know, the dark state, or you can ask me about, am I going to get the job next week, or should I leave my husband? Doesn't matter. Whatever questions you ask, I will, the first position will say the way it appears. The second position will say what's really going on. And the third position will say what needs to come out now, or what you need to attend to now. And I'll just read the cards, you know, and it's always pretty interesting what comes out, I think.
How accurate are the tarot cards when combined with a reading? What would you say?
Well, what I would say is 100%, but with several caveats. One, the first important thing is the person has to be sincere. If the person is like, yanking my chain or just thinking it's a silly Pollard game,
right,
the cards won't work. The second point that I say is 100% accurate is a misnomer. Accurate doesn't mean anything. Accurate compared to what? Compared to a person's own opinion about what's going on? The better word than accurate is relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And there I would say 100% relevant, because it has to be, because our minds are nothing more than walking tarot decks, and we just get to look at several little parts in any reading, and they're always relevant because the tarot is us. The tarot is a part of us, and we get to look through a window and look at certain parts of us, and that's always relevant.
Now, where is the strength of the tarot? Was it the reader or the person? Now, if a person's with you, do they pull those cards?
Yes.
They do.
I guide them into selection, even over the phone. If people want to call me to set up an appointment with me, I have a method of where a person will actually select it through me. I have a way that they can do it by guiding my hand. We won't have time for that tonight. I will just
instincts. Okay. And then nowadays with Zoom, what if they have a tarot deck, you're on the other end, and they have their cards, and you tell them to pick three cards, and they do and show them to you?
I do it all the time.
Well, that works that way, doesn't it?
Oh, of course. Ultimately, the secret is, George, it doesn't matter. It's going to work any way you want to do it. And I just trust it. And you'll see. But I think it's valuable if a person does select their own cards rather than the reader, only insofar as they get a more investment in the answer, because they feel that they're more involved with the process, and that's a good thing. But if they empower the reader, or say myself tonight, that I am, you know, I'm just totally going to trust my intuition and just go to the card that my hand just seems to want to go to, it's about the same thing. It doesn't really matter.
Why do the tarot cards have the amount of cards they have in the deck?
Well, this is a big question, one that my last book on the subject has debated. We have the minor arcana, you know, the ace to king, and those are numbered, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, et cetera, with the courts. But the trumps, or let me say the higher keys, the number 22, I challenge that, and I believe there should be 27 cards, not 22, because I believe if you really penetrate the inner metalogic of the major arcana, you'll see that it makes the most sense with three rows of nine. And when you lay it out, and I call that the matrix, when you lay it out in that matrix, you'll see that there's an incredible interconnection between each of those roads that tell a story or a pathway. There's nine different pathways in the major arcana. That is not as obvious in the current dispensation, as we say, where there's only 22 cards, and so the third row is short five cards. In my deck, Tarot of the Nine Paths, which you've seen, I've read your cards with it, and which we'll use tonight, it will include the five new emerging archetypes that, after 3 years of deep study and work on it, I believe are the missing tarot cards.
Interesting take on all that. It's fascinating. It truly is remarkable how it works, and you know, the readings and stuff. And at any point, is there an alteration in the cards where, you know, you're not an evil person by any means, but can something demonic enter into this?
You know, I suppose it could. You know, it depends on who's reading the cards and who's getting read, and that doesn't really occur in my, you know, in the work I do. But I know that there are people that are into demonic things that probably use the cards to channel or whatever all they use them for. The tarot is kind of like an empty vessel, and it is really how, you know, who the reader is and how it is used that will determine the result. I think if you know, in my case, I rarely have had that experience, though occasionally I've had some pretty strange people come in for readings, and I've picked up some dark energy from people, that, and as they talk about it, I encourage people to share what their experience of the card is. Then that can be more apparent.
Well, let's take the calls with you when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.